Friday, July 20th, many of us were at Soldier Field to celebrate the 50th anniversary. But the person that kind of brought us together, did bring us together, was the next speaker. She came up with this athletic competition. She teamed up with Eunice Kennedy, and they called it the Special Olympics. And as I've said so often, I feel it, this helped change the world forever. Supreme Court Justice Anne Burke. Justice Burke.
Well, thank you, Jay. Thank everyone today for being here. Good afternoon. And I'd like to thank the City Club members as well for inviting us to discuss the current crisis in the Catholic Church. When I last had the opportunity to speak to the City Club audience regarding this topic, it was March 3rd, 2004, 14 years ago. To quote from my talk at that time regarding the release of the National Review Board's report, I said, as a rational thinking person and a legal professional, I have had to recognize the difference between the church and the hierarchy. I hope we all do. While some of our leaders may have failed us, others among them have sought to set things right. I believe they have begun to accomplish this in convening the unprecedented lay board on which I have been serving. It is a deep expression of their real willingness to respond to this abuse crisis in the most effective and systemic way possible. That was 14 years ago. Now I realize I was mistaken in thinking the hierarchy in the Catholic Church would implement the recommendations in the report of the National Review Board. It is my pleasure this afternoon to moderate this distinguished panel to assess the current crisis in the Catholic Church and recurrent sexual abuse scandals. Those scandals have been drawn into sharper, renewed focus in the recent months as a result of the lengthy probe into the handling of a multitude of abuse claims brought against the Pennsylvania Catholic Diocese. In the years following the 2002 formation of the National Review Board by the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops as an independent, totally independent body of lay men and women whose mission and purpose was to advise the conference in ending the epidemic of sexual abuse against minors in the United States by those in service of the church, appeared to begin doing something. However, this new crisis, sadly and tragically, has emerged. And that is why the present time of crisis, a crisis of leadership, we will be discussing two of the problems of the National Review Board of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops confronted 16 years ago. The intransience and unwillingness of the Conference of Bishops to grant us, the National Review Board, the authority to investigate the bishops and the cardinals. And number two, the credible evidence in a willful and elaborate cover-up of these undeniably horrifying sexual crimes committed against underage victims by priests. Now it is clear that a code of silence permeated the diocese across the United States. We did recommend an adoption of a whistleblower policy. Obviously, it wasn't adopted by the bishops. Present today to discuss these matters is my friend and Dr. Kathleen McChesney, esteemed former FBI Executive Assistant Director, the former special agent in charge of the Chicago Division, and the first executive director of the Office of Child and Youth Protection of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, and also an author. Since 2002, Dr. McChesney has traveled the world to establish prevention programs aimed at stemming sexual abuse. She is currently the CEO of Kinsale Management, consulting, providing strategic services to businesses and non-for-profit organizations. Dr. McChesney, will you please join me? Also on the panel today is Robert S. Bennett, a good friend and one of our nation's preeminent trial attorneys. Bob has co-chaired several American Bar Association National Institute programs and represented former President Bill Clinton and two former Secretaries of the Defense, Clark Clifford and Caspar Weinberger, in high-profile litigation. He is a fellow of the American College of Trial Lawyers and at various times served as special counsel to the United States Senate Committee on Ethics, and is an author also in his latest book, In the Ring, The Trials of a Washington Lawyer. Bob was also the primary author of the National Review Board's report on the crisis of the Catholic Church in the United States, February 27, 2004. Bob, will you please join us? Right. Can you all hear me? Okay.
Bless you.
Bless you. Okay. For Bob, the National Review Board conducted a thorough investigation into clerical sexual abuse and reported the number of offenders and victims. So why, after 14 years, are we still learning about grand juries convening across the country to investigate priests who abused minors?
Well, it's because the bishops really didn't follow all of our recommendations. In fact, we were prohibited from looking into the bishops. Our task was simply to look into the priests. And we didn't have subpoena power. We didn't have access to the documents. I'm going to be as candid with you. I think you deserve that. The Vatican and its structure really consists of, and I can say this because I'm an old man, is a bunch of old men who don't really want to reform anything. They're very satisfied, for the most part, with what they have. And change is an enemy. Women, to them, they're threatened by women. And so it just goes on and on. And recently, we learned that Cardinal McCarrick was continually elevated into the church, even though many of the folks in the Vatican were aware of allegations against him regarding, for the most part, young seminarians and also with some minors. I really hate to say that because he was a very close, dear friend of mine. I loved the man. And in my book, I say that on many times when I was very depressed about our work, what we were doing, what we were learning, I sort of said, well, you know, here's a bright light, though. Cardinal McCarrick, you know, he's a humble man. He's a man who is not taken with the perks of office. And I couldn't have been more wrong. And so that's a partial answer, Ann.
Bob, I've never known you to only give a partial answer. Anyway, we still have lots of questions for you. Kathleen, do you have any ideas with regard to why we're still talking about this 14 years later?
Thank you, Anne, and thank you for allowing me to be here this morning. Just let me say one thing, too, before I answer your question, and that's that there is a possibility that one or more of you in the room have been victims of some type of sexual abuse, whether committed by a member of the Catholic Church or someone you know or someone you didn't know, or maybe somebody in your family has been a victim. And so let me first say I'm sorry for what has happened. One in four women in this country are victims of sexual abuse or attempts at sexual abuse, and one in six men. So it's a very important topic. And when you ask me why are we still talking about this, it is because it is still prevalent in our society. We look at it in the Catholic Church more closely because the people who are our offenders are people who are representing God to so many people, especially to children who don't really know the distinction between God and an authority figure who's representing the church. So the problem continues, but I think it's important to note that there has been progress in the Catholic Church in the sense of diminishing the number of cases that have been occurring over time. During the peak years, which were in the 1970s, there were, over the decade of the 70s, there were about 271 on average cases per year. During the past 15 years, that number has dropped to about 13 cases per year. Now, one case is dreadful and reprehensible, but the fact that those numbers have gone down can, I believe, be attributed to the fact that prevention programs do work. Abuse awareness programs do work.
You know, I have a number of grandchildren who are in Catholic schools, and I feel very safe about that. I don't think they're at risk like they used to be. I'd like to think that our board had something to do with that, but I have to tell you that I think the main reason is that the law enforcement authorities are no longer staying away from the church, and they are investigating and prosecuting and subpoenaing and various places. You just saw in Pennsylvania. And now many other states are saying it's no longer hands off. Forget separation of church and state. We're coming after you. And that gets their attention.
I agree with you, Bob, exactly on that. Sexual abuse is a crime across this country, in every state, and in many countries across the world. The first response should be a law enforcement response. The second response would be come from the organization.
And as a result of the National Review Board's work on that, Kathleen, isn't it true that every diocese, and good example is here in Chicago, that there is sufficient training, background checks, and all? But who is watching over to make sure all the other dioceses around the country are as convincingly trusted as we would say in the Chicago Archdiocese as a result of some of the work?
Well, when the bishops set forth their programs in 2002, one of the things that the National Review Board did and oversaw was the implementation of an audit process, an external audit process, to make certain that each of the 195 dioceses around the country was compliant with having background checks done, having abuse awareness training done, and the audit checks that on an annual basis. There's an annual report about this. But in the years that have passed since 2002, since what we call the spotlight years, you have seen sort of a fatiguing of the issue. And so in the past 5 to 10 years, people have not paid attention to those numbers. They've not paid attention to the fact that there have been audits of the diocese to make certain that they're compliant with those procedures. And there's better screening. I'm not saying it's as good as it should be, but better screening for seminarians as well.
Bob, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I think Kathleen has covered it well. Yeah.
Well, some people allege that the church leadership has been turning a blind eye to the abuse epidemic because of their lack of accountability to the lay people in church. And that's why last week, Bob, you appeared at Georgetown University and you were amazed at the number of people and some other issues. Can you explain to us what happened last week?
Well, it was somewhat remarkable. There was 650, 700 people there on this issue. And it was amazing to me. I think what's happened is the laity has realized that it's their church. It's not the church of the Vatican and those in the Vatican. It is our church. And I think the Vatican, I'm using that term in a general sense, is becoming almost irrelevant. It's your relationship with God that matters. Who asks, what politician asks the church anymore what their moral position is on an issue? I remember when I was in school, they did it all the time. Now they don't even bother because they say, well, you can't even keep your own house in order. And people are pretty fed up. The Catholics are pretty fed up. My own daughters, who are older now, they don't. What does the church do for them? They're second class citizens. So I think, but you see, one of the problems is while the laity feels that way, they don't have any place to go. I mean, maybe they go to their local priest or even occasionally their local bishop, but it doesn't go anyplace. It's like a glass ceiling. And I think one of the things that has to be done is I think that we should create like a National Association of Concerned Catholics. And the head of that or a representative of that should have a seat at the table in the Vatican. I don't mean they have to be a priest, but they would have to have access to the folks there because no input is given into the Vatican and the people there. You and I have talked about this, our complaints just go, they go up there someplace in the cloud, whatever that is, and nothing is really done about it.
Bob, you mentioned the Vatican. When we were on the National Review Board, we did visit the Vatican. Why don't you tell the audience some of our experiences going to meet with some of the curial cardinals?
Well, it was interesting. It started out on the wrong foot because being a good little Catholic boy, I knew I just couldn't get in touch with the Vatican. I didn't have their phone number. Look it up in the phone book, it doesn't say Vatican call. So I played by the rules, and I called our local nuncio. And, of course, he wouldn't return the call, but one of his third-level delegates called me and said, I'm sorry, Mr. Bennett, you and the board. Now, don't forget, this is not a plaintiff's organization. This is a creature of the bishops. He's sorry. The nuncio just doesn't feel that this subject is within his jurisdiction. And I said, somewhat irreverently, child abuse is not within his jurisdiction. No, Mr. Bennett, I'm sorry. So then I did something with Anne's permission. She was running the show. I sent a bunch of faxes to them. And I got admonished by one of the bishops for that. He said, you don't send faxes to the Vatican. And I said, well, before you get too upset with me, let me tell you, I got faxes back. One was from Cardinal Ratzinger, who at the time was the second most powerful person in Rome. And a year later, he became Pope Benedict. And so Anne, Bill Burley, who very prominent Catholic layman who was the head of what, Scripps?
Scripps Howard.
Scripps Howard. We went over there, and it was pretty remarkable. We met with Cardinal Ratzinger for 2 hours. I mean, you can't even get to see the guy, and if you do, it's 5 minutes. And we were there for 2 hours. And it wasn't us. It was he was hearing things for the first time. We told him about things, and he couldn't believe what he was hearing. Wasn't that your reaction?
Yes.
And so we felt it was a successful meeting, and we left and said, well, let's go have a good Italian dinner. And we had a crazy cab driver, I remember. And believe it or not, Cardinal Law stepped off the curb, and we missed him by about 6 inches. And I could just see the headlines, Catholic Review Board wipes out Cardinal Law. You know.
So. Kathleen, you, as a former FBI agent and head of the Office of Child and Youth Protection, organized the first audit whereby you hired personally 55 former FBI agents to go into the diocese of and eparchies in the United States. Were the bishops all that grateful to see you?
Well, you must remember that the audits, the idea of the audits themselves, was part of the bishop's plan going forward, which is set forth in their Charter for the Protection of Children and Young People. I think that there were probably some bishops who didn't think that the day would ever come when they would be audited by lay professionals who were outside of the employ of the church. So I think there was shock on the part of some. But over time, because I think we established a credible process, it's not an investigative process, it's a compliance review process. But because of that, I think many bishops have come to rely on the expertise of the auditors, particularly in the early years when we used people who had law enforcement experience and who had, many of whom had management experience. And one of the things that, for those of you who work in or are perhaps familiar with the church and how it does business, is that it doesn't do business. The church is the church, and the business belongs to the business world. And that's one of the things that I think contributes to the confusion about what the church is about. Many people don't understand its structure. Many people still think that in the United States there must be some bishop who is in charge of all other bishops. That's not the case. All bishops report to Rome in the same way that, you know, all roads lead to Rome. That is how it works in the United States. If there were structural changes, then perhaps you could have people who are closer geographically and culturally to the issues to hold bishops accountable for actions they've taken or not taken.
As a follow-up to that, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops President, Cardinal Daniel DiNardo, and Cardinal Sean O'Malley and Cardinal Jose Gomez were summoned to Rome just on September 13th, just a few weeks ago. And since then, I don't think we've heard anything from them. It's what happened at the meeting. So with regard to structure, I know that that there was a cry for having a authorized apostolic visit to the United States. And it appears that with no word from Rome, that nothing's going to happen. Do you believe that, Kathleen, with knowing about the structures of the church?
Well, I don't have any inside information about that. I do know that the Bishops' Conference, through its president, Cardinal DiNardo, has asked the Holy See for an apostolic visitation. What that means, for those of you that don't understand that, is that the Holy See would appoint someone to come to the United States, or maybe even someone here, who is a cleric, who would lead an investigation into the allegations in this case, having to do with Cardinal McCarrick and why he was able to be promoted within the church when allegedly different individuals knew that he had abused seminarians. So I think that the process is still underway in terms of appointing someone to do this. But another point that I like to make about an apostolic visitation, while that is authorized by the Holy See, it has to be a partnership to be credible at this point in time. It has to be a partnership that includes lay professionals who have law enforcement experience, investigative experience, who have some knowledge of the church. Others have said that an apostolic visitation is not the right thing to do, that it should be just a total external investigation without clerics involved. And so that's, I don't believe that's something that's being debated at the Holy See, but I don't know yet, and I think we're going to have to wait.
And do you remember when we interviewed Kathleen for the job?
I do.
And she came in, and you said, well, you know, these bishops and cardinals, they're a bunch of tough old men, and you think you can handle them? And your response was, well, she was number three in the bureau. She said, well, I deal with tough old men all the time, and they have guns.
There's one story, and I hope Kathleen doesn't get mad at me for telling the story, but as a board, we would go around the country and try to go to have our meetings as a board in each one of the board members' dioceses. And we were ready to go to New York, and the member of the board was Pamela Hayes, a lawyer in New York, and we got word that Cardinal Egan, who is actually on Oak Park, he would like to say he's from Chicago, but he's from Oak Park, said, I don't want that FBI agent in a skirt coming into New York. That's the kind of pushback that we got. And I know Kathleen, as she went around and her men went around and women to investigate, not all dioceses cooperate. Is that right, Kathleen?
Well, that's correct. First, let me finish on what you said. I did go to New York, and it didn't matter to
me.
We
had our meeting, right?
And I probably wore a skirt, too, but that's neither here nor there. There was a bishop who declined to take part in the audits for several years, and that was the bishop of Lincoln, Nebraska. He's since been replaced, and they are participating in the audits. But a real interesting point there is the fact that all his brother bishops were participating, and the fact that he declined, there was no consequence whatsoever. And I was wondering where the lay people were in his diocese that weren't insisting that they have the external audits. And if there's a point I think that we all wanted to make by us being here today, it is, first of all, to thank all of you as laypersons for being interested and hopefully activists on these issues and making certain that your respective bishops or archbishops or cardinals, whatever they might be, as well as the provincials of the religious communities, because a third of the priests in the country are members of religious communities and not necessarily associated with dioceses. So what we would hope is that you would continue to make your voices heard about things that are going on that either you don't understand or you think need to be corrected within the church, whatever the issue may be. And I mean, this is much broader, of course, than abuse, but abuse is the most important thing right now.
Bob, we had been talking earlier about some of the things that possibly need to be changed in the church. And if even though the bishops didn't necessarily in the cardinals pay attention to our recommendations about accountability on their behalf, what do you think needs to, more broadly, what needs to be changed in the church, in the hierarchy?
This is where I get close to being excommunicated, I should tell you. Let me make one point. Our investigation was very serious, and at the time I was at Wayne's law firm, Skadden Arps. And I got the permission of Wayne and others to really do it right. And at the end of the day, we wrote off $2 million in time because of the use of various brilliant young lawyers and not so young lawyers. And I only mention that number because it shows Wayne and his partner's commitment, even though many were Jewish and Protestants. But this was serious, and this was a serious investigation. Now, I've been thinking about these issues for a long time, and especially the last 20 years. So here's what I think, to get very practical. And believe me, I'm not naive. I have no belief that in my lifetime or lifetimes after, this will be done. But if you want to make this a healthy church and solve many of the problems, here's what I would recommend. First, I'm absolutely convinced that celibacy should be voluntary. To some, celibacy is a great gift. To others, it's an albatross which leads priests into heavy drinking, womanizing, etc. And we don't even talk about womanizing anymore, but you know, this is all about power. And there are many, many priests I came across in the last 20 years who will counsel women who are having trouble in their marriage and winding up trying to bed them. So I really think celibacy has got to be voluntary. I think we should have married priests if they choose. We have priests in the church that are married, those Episcopalian priests who become Catholics, the Marianites, and I'm sure there are others. Yes, I know that there'll be other problems, divorces and things. But those problems, I think, are nothing compared to what we have. Third, I think we should have women priests. There's no good reason not to have women priests. This is not a matter of... I have discovered in our investigation and elsewhere, some of these nuns are the best people we have in our church. And I can't... Can you imagine a woman priest sitting at breakfast with a male bishop and he says, I think I'm going to send Jones to Idaho and maybe he'll stop this abusing? I mean, it wouldn't happen. Not it wouldn't happen. And as I said earlier, I think that... We need to have a lay position in the Vatican with some kind of authority, so they have access. I mean, think about it. In this day and age, to say, you know, women can't be priests. I mean, my wife was the president of SOAR, the Support Our Aging Religious, and these great men in the Vatican have treated nuns like garbage. So. You know, those are my views for very practical solutions. But, you know, the chance of this happening is negligible. Why? Because if you have a priest who's at all reform-minded, they're never going to get up to the real power base because the people who get up there are the identical people who are there already. And they don't want young bishops or young priests to rock the boat. Now, that's just a fact of the matter. And you can talk around that stuff, but that's the way it is. And that's based on my views of over 20 years. Focusing on it 20 years.
Kathleen, do you believe that this movement that's in the church, those who are against Pope Francis... And those who are more conservative, shall we say, are trying to put blame on homosexual priests. Our report shows otherwise. Is that not true?
Well, there are a couple of questions in the question there. And one has to do with our people putting people who have certain agendas, either pro-gay or anti-gay, are they fighting each other over the issue of sex abuse? And I think that, yes, they are. I think it's a very sad thing that you have, or the appearance of people on both sides fighting each other about the most important thing, which is protecting children. And that gets lost by the wayside when they're talking about whose ideology is the most important, and whether people like Pope Francis or they don't like Pope Francis, or they like his appointments or they don't like his appointments. None of that matters if you're not focused on the child. With regard, well, go ahead, Bob, please.
Let me, you know, that's the elephant in the room. We recommended further study on the subject of homosexuality. Nobody knows precisely, but I've heard of statistics that probably 30 to 50% or more of the priests have homosexual tendencies. Certainly most of the cases involve homosexual conduct. So you can't just wish it away. But there's a big difference between a man who has a tendency and one who acts on it. And I think it would be terrible for the church to get rid of men who simply had a homosexual tendency. These young priests who were of a homosexual orientation, they didn't get any training or how to cope with it or in their careers. They were told, like I was told in high school, take a cold shower. You know, you can't do that. And so I think that's something that requires a lot of attention, a lot of attention. But by the same token, heterosexual men who go in, you have to be sure that they keep that what their tendencies are and not to be acting out with women. So, you know, you have to be very careful. And one of the things with this Vigano letter looks to me like there may be an effort to sort of rid the church of homosexual-oriented men, which I think would not be good for the church.
Do you believe that the Pope needs to take more active leadership role here in the United States? It seems like there's some sort of a disconnect between what the lay people have been talking about and what the hierarchy has been talking about, and the inactiveness to some degree about listening to the lay people. Kathleen?
Bless you.
One of the problems with being the leader of the largest Christian organization in the world is that you only have so many moments in the day. From those of us in the United States that really understand organizations and structures, the person in charge at the top isn't the person that's going to get a lot of the things done. And I think that here in the United States, if you had some decentralization of power within the church, you would be able to handle the issues more nimbly and more effectively. So to say it would be better if the Pope were involved in all of our issues, I don't think that's the answer. I think the answer is something here in the United States where you have the kind of leadership that can actually get things done and hold people accountable within the church within the United States. Just to give you an example, there are a number of offenders over the years who have been identified, clergy who have abused minors or vulnerable adults. A number of these people were proposed for laicization. There are literally hundreds of those cases awaiting the judicial decision at the Holy See about whether or not to laicize these men. That shouldn't be. Those cases should be completed very quickly because there's evidence some of these people have gone to jail and so forth. So if you had a system where you could adjudicate here in the United States more quickly and then save the work of the folks in Rome and the various dicasteries for appeals only, you could get this process done, you could get better accountability, and you wouldn't have these people who are still lingering in the priesthood. Bob?
No, I agree with that.
Okay. I think that we've pretty much said what we were planning on saying, unless there's some final comment before we take questions. Okay. I can't believe there's only one question here. Okay. This is from Dr. Shannon. Doctor, do you want to stand and ask your question?
Sure.
Okay, thank you.
My handwriting's that bad.
I was thinking I can't. I didn't want to say that, but I was going to say it. I thought it might be some sort of a prescription for me. You know?
My question relates to the study in 2002 by the John Jay College that was commissioned by the bishops. And I've got a couple of questions about it. One is, does the panel think that that is a study that should be periodically redone? But the second question is, and I think, Justice, you got to this with your opening comments. My recollection is that study was done by self-report from the diocese. And I wonder if you could contrast that and what was unearthed with the subpoena power in Pennsylvania.
All right. Well,
the question, please.
It was a two-part question. Should the report that was issued by the National Review Board be reviewed and continually updated? And the other was, what was the issue with regard to the grand jury in Pennsylvania and their subpoena power? What was the difference? Because, Kathleen, you could probably answer that a little better, but you could start. We can all comment on it.
Well, I think I understood the question just a little bit differently. Doctor, you asked about the study in 2002 that was commissioned by the bishops for the John Jay study. Is that what you're referring to? And that was separate from the National Review Board report. Mm-hmm. But in the John Jay study, the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, not a Catholic institution, but a very reputable research institution, surveyed all the dioceses in the country to find out what the nature and scope of the problem of abuse was. And your question is, should there be a new study in that regard? I don't think there needs to be a new study. There is a process in place by which the CARA, a research group from Georgetown University, collects that data every year and puts it in an annual report. What's important to note there is that a lot of people don't know that. And as often as there's press releases and so forth, those numbers have been added to every year since 2004 when the John Jay report came out. Mm-hmm. That's a different issue than being transparent and disclosing the names of offenders. And that is something that this board, that my office, that we recommended back in 2002, that if you're going to be transparent, you need to let people know who those offenders are. Here in the Archdiocese of Chicago, names were released. In other places around the country, names have been released, but it's not universal, and it's absolutely something that needs to be done so that victims can heal and so that other people who haven't reported will be able to know that they're not alone, whether they ever come forward or not. Knowing that you're not alone goes so far in helping that person who's been victimized to heal.
Bob?
No.
Okay. There are a number of questions, and one of them was why the Archdiocese of Chicago was not on the panel. Well, there was no one other than myself and two other members from the Archdiocese of Chicago that were on the National Review Board. So this was about the National Review Board and not about what any archdiocese or diocese in the country has done or not done. Dr. Shannon, was your question answered?
Yes.
Okay. And from Kate Moylan Minnie, short of a schism, how can laity take over and force a restructuring of the church? Is a restructuring of hierarchy possible? Power of the purse, all questions. Okay.
No, I don't think it's possible, but I do think if we were able to have a seat at the table at the Vatican, we might be able to influence some of the decisions. Also, I think if the laity realizes it's their church, perhaps those in the Vatican will realize that if they don't get on with the program, they're going to become more and more irrelevant and remote.
You don't have okay. With Kate O'Malley, she's with KO Strategies. It seems as if the choice that Catholics have is to stay and fight for the church or find another Christian church. If we stay, what realistically can we do to reform the Catholic Church so we see that the issue is addressed in our lifetime?
Well, that's very similar to the last question in terms of how the laity can move forward. Like I said before, using your voice, letting your bishops and cardinals and provincial superiors know how you feel, and come forward with concrete suggestions like Bob has about, you know, insisting on a seat at the table. You have congregations like Congregation for Clergy or Congregation for Bishops in the Holy See. If they had lay advisory boards, councils, who could listen to their issues and provide a perspective from the laity, I think that would be at least a small step towards making some fundamental structural changes.
Judge, didn't you tell me that, if I remember correctly, that some of the very wealthiest contributors to the church are withholding?
Yes, I've seen some checks that have been written and with nothing in it.
Yeah. So.
Yes. There's also, I think that with regard to what lay people can do is doing what you're doing here, and that is attending forums where this discussion can be talked about. Bob told you about the other evening last week where he was at Georgetown, where there were over 600 people talking about the issue as lay people, what they should do. I mean, I was at Old St. Pat's last Monday night with 400 people talking about this issue. And I think that's exactly what we should be doing, is having a conversation about this issue and be engaged in our church as lay people and insisting that our parishes and our dioceses across the country have these conversations and include the bishop, include the cardinal, so they know what you're thinking. If you're not talking about it with them, then you can't possibly know what's going on. So I'd like to also talk about, actually, the one thing that I do want to point out to you is everybody is angry. And I think, Bob, you said the same thing. Kathleen, I know you go around the world, actually, and talk to people and have been discussing this for the last 15 years in countries all over the world. And people want to be Catholic. They want to be part of the church. And your words to them, I can probably quote, but I won't. I'll let you do it.
Well, back in 2002, which, again, we call this sort of the spotlight years, for those of you that have seen the movie and knew that's when the Catholic Church faced this crisis to begin with, I said to you, use your voice. But there's another part of that, and I want to give a shout-out, really, to the media, to the Boston Globe for doing their investigative report, to the secular media as well as the Catholic media. Many of you may not read much in the Catholic literature, but there is a lot of information there, and bishops do read that, and they do listen. I'm not going to say 100% because I wouldn't say that, but many of them pay attention to the ideas that are brought forth from lay professionals. One thing I've seen over the last 15 years or so is the fact that many of the bishops that I work with, at least, have really come to have a high regard for the expertise that people bring forth, whether they're attorneys, but more important in the social science areas, psychology, sociology. They listen to what people are thinking and saying. But again, it, you know, there have to be more voices. They have to be louder. We have to make certain that the media doesn't let the issue go, as it did after 2004, 2005. Many people that saw the Spotlight movie, for example, were just not familiar with what had happened in 2002. Every day, a child is at risk for being abused by someone who is a predator, whether it's in a school or in an organization or in their own family. So as adults, we have to be vigilant about this. We are responsible for protecting young people. They're not responsible for protecting themselves.
You know, one of the things that we learned, if you remember, is that the lawyers for the diocese acted like they were working for insurance companies and they were risk managers. I remember one case we came across. There was a six-year-old little girl who was molested, and the lawyer for the diocese submitted a pleading saying that she was contributory negligent. I mean, how crazy is that? And if your focus is protecting funds, avoiding scandal, and not the well-being of children, you're never going to solve these problems.
And that's exactly true, and that's what everybody's saying. And every one of the questions really are saying, what do you do if you believe that your bishop or your cardinal isn't addressing them? What can be done? And I think, Kathleen, you've stated we've got to be louder. We've got to have the press help us. And also another question was, and they asked us to discuss it, do you think really withholding money and contributions will have a real impact?
Well, the trouble with that is, I mean, we're being pretty tough on the church here today, or at least this organized church. We do a lot of wonderful things like Catholic Charities and things. And you know, you don't want to withhold funds at the expense of things like Catholic Charities and things like that. So, you know, I'm troubled about this idea of just withholding money. I would withhold money in a minute to contribute to a portrait of a cardinal. You know, let him pay for his own portrait. I mean, but good works, charitable works, you know.
I totally agree with you, Bob, on the fact that if you withhold money, you may be withholding, you know, salaries of educators or people that are doing important ministries. Right. I don't think that is necessarily the answer. But yeah. Where you can be activist is making certain that your parishes and your diocese are open and transparent about how they spend money. In a lot of parishes, you know, once a year there's maybe an insert in the bulletin that says, well, here's how we've spent the money this year. You know, is that going in the trash, or do you actually take time to look at it? Are you part of finance councils? Do you support finance councils? If your parish doesn't have a finance council, are you asking why? If the diocese doesn't share with you information about their finances, do you ever ask why? If not, you should.
Last call for one more question.
Well,
yes.
I have a joke I want to tell.
Oh,
after.
Yes. Okay. All right. Final remarks. Okay.
You want me to tell it now?
Yeah.
Well,
there's a couple more questions.
One more question over here.
And then final.
And then final.
I'm just curious about when you talk about a seat at the table, how you figure the best way to get that person or those people in place. What would the process be if they would say, or who you would want in the seat? Thank you.
Well, there's a lot of Catholic power in this room, and We got to convince somehow the Vatican to give us a place. I think we have to organize in the sense of some kind of a national organization of Catholics who have concerns and do everything within our power to influence our bishops to say, look, let's get a layman in a position not to talk about church doctrine, but so they can be heard, so they have access to the people who have the power.
Okay. Well, that was the last question, so you can have your closing statement, Kathleen and Bob, if you wish.
Kathleen?
Well, first of all, thank you all for the opportunity to talk about this important topic once again. Please don't let it go by the wayside, as it has in years past. The news cycle, we fatigue of difficult issues. I totally understand that. But it's just too important. And do look to all the organizations. You are leaders in the community. Look to, and I know what's been going on here in Chicago, but across the land, in organizations, make certain that good procedures are in place to protect children. Make certain that if you see something that is untoward, particularly if you see a cleric who is possibly violating some boundary with a young person or a vulnerable adult, that you come forward. Don't just sit and say, well, that's another rumor or that's bothering me. Come forward. Let the right people investigate it.
All right, Bob, it's your turn.
Okay. This has been a very depressing lunch. So I want to try to cheer you up a little bit. And for those who've heard this story, I apologize. There is this brilliant young lawyer named Joe Collins. And he dies at a very early age of 40. And he goes up to heaven. And there's St. Peter at the gates. And he's a little upset. He says, why? Because I'm so young. And St. Peter said, well, you know, God just wants you up here with him. You've been so brilliant and good, and you go to Mass every day, and you contribute. You know, God wants you with him. And in fact, I'm under instructions to ask you, is there anything at all we can do for you while you're here? And Collins thinks, and he said, to tell you the truth, he said, I would love to meet the Blessed Mother. I do a novena to her every week. She's the center of my life. And St. Peter says, wow, that's a tall order, but I'll do what I can. And he gets back to Collins, and he said, well, I can do it. I've gotten the okay, and she's over there where those pink clouds are and the angels. And so he goes over there to see her. And it's an incredible meeting. They talk, and she knows all about him, and they talk. And after about a half an hour, he said, Blessed Mother, I don't want to be presumptuous, but you don't look very happy. And she said, well, Collins, I understand why you're such a good lawyer. I am a little sad. And he said, why? Millions and millions of people pray to you all every day. You're the mother of Jesus Christ. What's there to be unhappy about? And she says to Collins, she says, well, to tell you the truth, I wanted a girl.